and rushing wind noise of the landing gear being lowered startled her out of a pleasant dream about a picnic with her kids. As she rubbed the sleep from her eyes, the plane landed with a screech of tires on the long concrete runway. Craning her neck to look out at the Caracas airport in the early morning sunlight, Van Buren saw that the plane was taxiing to a remote corner of the facility, far from any buildings or other planes. The only thing out there was a tall wire mesh fence topped by razor wire, and a big square army truck in chocolate chip camouflage. As the plane squealed to a stop, a full squad of young soldiers piled out of the truck, automatic rifles in their hands, and formed up in a straight line. "What's going on?" one of her technicians asked. "Don't worry," Van Buren assured him. "It's okay. Nothing to worry about." She hoped she was right. The captain came out of the cockpit, stooped over because of the cabin's low ceiling, and swung the hatch open. A metal stairway automatically unfolded from the plane's fuselage. A trim-looking young soldier immediately clambered up the steps, looking very serious. He had some sort of insignia on the collar of his shirt, a thick, dark mustache, and a pistol holstered on his hip. "Señora Van Buren," he called out. "That's me," she replied, heading up the cabin's central aisle toward him. The soldier was short enough to stand erect at the hatch. "I am Capitán Esteban Guterres, comandante of your security detail," he said in heavily accented English. Then he smiled brilliantly. "Welcome to Venezuela." Len Kinski wasn't exactly panicked, but he certainly felt nervous. His date with April had been a total waste of time. They spent the whole evening fencing verbally. He tried to find out from her what Dan was up to, and gradually realized that she was trying to find out what he was doing. "She knows," Kinski realized, halfway through his bland chunk of dead fish at Lamar's fanciest restaurant. "She's trying to pump me." By the time he got home that evening, there was a message on his answering machine from Roberto. The big mook was coming down to Matagorda. Great, thought Kinski. He'd only met Roberto in the flesh once, but that was enough. Plenty, in fact. The guy looked like he should be playing linebacker for some prison football team. Scary. Roberto wasn't satisfied with the flow of information Kinski was providing him. Kinski had to admit that he hadn't much information to pass on, and now April was probably on to him. What to do? As he drove to the ferry that morning, Kinski wished he'd never met Roberto. Never gone for the money the big lug offered. All they'd wanted was a pipeline into Dan's office. Industrial espionage happens all the time. With Astro going down the toilet and his job going with it, Kinski figured a little extra money on the side was a good bet. Insurance for that inevitable day when Dan called him in and sadly told him he was laid off. Yeah, good bet. Kinski sat and fidgeted while the ferry chugged across the bay. Maybe I ought to just pull up stakes and go back to New York. I can sell some freelance magazine articles if nothing else pans out. The ferry docked. As he drove the last few miles to the office, Kinski formed a plan of action. Roberto wants the inside poop on what Dan's up to. Otherwise, he's going to get nasty. Maybe he was involved in Tenney's death. Kinski didn't like to think of that. Focus on the here and now, he commanded himself. Figure out what you've got to do and then do it. By the time he parked his car, he had made up his mind. He strode straight to Hangar A. In the distance, he could see that they'd rolled the grillwork gantry structure up to the booster and space plane perched on the launch pad. A thin wisp of vapor was wafting from one of the umbilicals connected to the space plane. Kinski stopped in mid-stride. Christ! They're fueling up the plane! He's really going to launch it! Kinski ran the rest of the way into the hangar and pounded up the steps, heading for Dan's office. Blockhouse. T-minus 10 minutes, the launch director's automated clock announced. Propellant top-off complete, said one of the technicians. Copy propellant top-off complete, said the launch director as he tapped a keypad on the board before him. He was balding, slightly overweight, so much in control of himself that Dan wondered if he ever perspired. In the corporate organization charts, he was Van Buren's assistant, although he had accumulated a career's worth of experience launching ballistic missiles for the Air Force before retiring from the military and coming to work for Astro. Of the six others sitting at the row of consoles inside the thick-walled concrete blockhouse, three were NASA veterans, the other three recent graduates of technical schools. All of them had headsets clamped over their hair. Their eyes were focused on the screens and gauges of their consoles. There were no windows in the blockhouse, but an oversized display screen that covered one entire wall showed the booster and space plane erect on the pad outside, with the rust-red tower of the gantry enveloping them protectively. Dan stood by the blockhouse's steel door, feeling the tightening of his nerves that he always experienced during a launch countdown. Firing off the solid-fuel booster was a simple operation compared to the big liquid-propellant rockets that NASA and other space agencies used. Still, the blockhouse felt hot and stuffy to Dan, damp with perspiration and the smell of tension. T-minus 7 minutes. Gantry rollback in 2 minutes. The intercom buzzed, a sudden annoying insect in the midst of the tight, business-like procedure. The kid handling outside communications pressed one hand against his earphone and whispered into his pin mic. The young man, a graduate student from Duke University, then turned in his swivel chair and motioned for Dan to pick up the phone on the concrete wall. Frowning with annoyance, Dan yanked the receiver off its cradle.
"Dan, what the fuck is going on?"
Kinski's voice, high, screeching. "Not now, Lynn," Dan said tightly into the phone.
"You're going to launch it?"
"Even higher. I'll talk to you when I get back to my office. Wait for me there."
"For Jesus Christ's sake, Dan, you can't..."
Dan hooked the receiver back into its cradle, then stepped over to the communication guy and tapped him on the shoulder. The kid looked up, and Dan drew a finger across his own throat. "No more incoming calls," he said, "no matter who it is." The young man nodded. Dan walked back to his spot by the door, where he could watch over the shoulders of the whole launch team. "The last thing I need is a phone call from PASO or some other government pain in the butt telling me I don't have permission to launch."
"T-minus 5 minutes. Begin gantry rollback."
"Confirm. Start rollback." Dan saw the big gantry structure begin to move slowly away from the rocket assembly, like the steel framework of a 25-story building rolling on a set of rails. The umbilical tower stood to one side of the launch pad, its electrical power cables and propellant hoses connected to the booster and spaceplane. "What's got Len so geared up?" Dan asked himself, and answered, "He's probably warped because I didn't let him know about the launch ahead of time. That must be it." Dan suppressed an urge to go outside. The tension was coiling tighter inside him. The launch crew was going smoothly through the countdown. No hitches, no glitches. But still, Dan's insides were clenching up just as hard as they used to when he'd been sitting inside a capsule at the top of a big rocket, waiting to be fired off into space, knowing that he was perched atop enough explosive power to blast the rocket and its cargo of human flesh into a roaring, hell-hot blossom of flames.
T-minus 4 minutes. Weather check.
The woman seated to the launch director's right punched several keys on her console, then said,
"Weather conditions all well above minimums. No problems."
"Weather confirmed," the launch director said.
Dan knew there would be no need to check weather conditions downrange, nor air traffic either. The rocket would lift off vertically, then pitch over slightly to head out over the Gulf as it swiftly rose above the altitude that air traffic used. "She'll be above controlled airspace in less than a minute," Dan told himself. "No sweat for the FAA or anybody else."
"Emergency landing sites?" the launch director asked, peering at the checklist on his console screen. The three sites in Spain, South Africa, and Australia had been alerted when the countdown had begun, less than an hour ago. Each of the airports confirmed that they were ready to clear all traffic if the spaceplane needed to abort its flight and make an emergency landing. Van Buren and her team had reported that they were ready at Caracas. Dan had talked to her before coming over to the blockhouse. Lynn seemed to be enjoying her sojourn in Venezuela, even though neither she nor the others with her had left the airport. The countdown proceeded. A tiny plume of white vapor wafted from the spaceplane's lower body. Liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen powered its rocket engines, so cold that they condensed the water vapor in the humid summer breeze drifting across the plane's propellant tanks into a miniature cloud of glittering droplets. His eyes riveted on the big wall screen, Dan saw that the sky outside was as clear as it ever gets, bright blue with only a few fat puffs of cumulus clouds floating slowly past.